You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. Today I'm joined by John Myers, co-founder of London YIMBY, which stands for Yes in My Backyard. The group campaigns for more homes in London and the rest of the UK. John talks me through the main obstacles that stand in the way of building more houses, and how the current system makes it near impossible for quantity and quality in the housing sector to go hand in hand. John explains how the severe imbalance between supply and demand for housing in the UK means that desperation to become a homeowner takes precedent, and often the aesthetics of property go out the window. John talks us through some solutions to the housing crisis, including allowing homeowners to have more control over planning permissions on their own street. Finally, John and I discuss the perverse incentives in politics around the housing crisis and what decisions could be made in Westminster to help more young people especially secure cheaper mortgages and cheaper rent. John, thanks so much for joining me today. Can you tell me a bit about where your campaign name YIMBY came from?
Certainly. So YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, the opposite of NIMBY. The campaigns called YIMBY have been going for over 10 years now. The first one started in Stockholm. We think the first use of the acronym we can track back is to a computer game in the 1990s. But the YIMBY movement really took off in California over the last few years, and it's done incredibly well over there. There's a San Francisco YIMBY, a California YIMBY campaign, and there are over 40 different cities with YIMBY campaigns in the States now.
And why is it so needed here in the UK to push back on people who say, not in my backyard?
We have a desperate shortage of housing. I mean, we haven't built enough homes in the right places for the last 40 years. In fact, since the Second World War, we've never got back to building housing at the rate that we grew the net housing stock in the 1830s before the railways, let alone the much higher rate that we built at in the 1930s.
That's deeply embarrassing, really. So housing briefing that the IEA published not too long ago found that since 1970, average house prices have risen 4.5-fold after inflation, and no other OECD country comes close to this.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. I mean, we're in a particularly bad situation, and the OECD recognizes that our housing supply is among the worst.
What are the main hindrances to building more homes? And are there any quick solutions, or is this going to be a very long and very painful process?
Well, I don't think there are any overnight solutions, but there are certainly plenty of things that we could do. We have plenty of room. I mean, so only 2-3% of England is built on with homes. And a lot of the parts that we do have built on aren't built very well or very densely. So if you compare, say, a 1930s suburb with a Bloomsbury Garden Square, the Bloomsbury Square will have 5 times the amount of housing in it, but many people would argue it actually looks better. Mm. So there's plenty of space, and there's also plenty of scope to do more with the land that we have.
So a lot of pushback comes from people who think that everything's going to look ugly. How could you build on the Greenbelt, destroy beautiful land to build some ugly, massive skyscraper? Why do you want to destroy the old, beautiful architecture in London? But to the point you just made, actually, we were more efficient at building homes in the past, and they look nicer than a lot of what's built today. So why can't quantity and quality go hand in hand?
I think the current system just doesn't work very well. You know, it was designed for very different times with a very different mindset, and also the percentage of homeowners has increased a lot over the last 60 years, and so there's a lot more people nearby fighting against it. And you know, it's tough to delve into all of the reasons why we get much lower quality coupled with not enough homes, but one of the main reasons is that land is so expensive, people are so desperate to find somewhere that they can afford to live in, that what the thing looks like goes out of the window and they just want a box with windows and a door. Mm. You know, and if homes were much more affordable, I mean, let's face it, 100 years ago a car basically cost the same as a house, you know, and so that shows you how well the car industry has done over the last 100 years and how badly our housing supply has done. If houses were much more affordable, people would be much more concerned with what they look like.
What about those who are deeply worried about the Greenbelt, who think, you know, why do you want to pave over all the parks? Why do you want to cement, chop down the trees and put cement over them? Is there any valid argument there?
Obviously, it's a valid concern that we shouldn't concrete over the country or the whole countryside, and I don't think we should concrete over parks at all, because you know, parks are desperately needed green living space in cities. But there are parts of the countryside that aren't that attractive, that aren't valued by local people, that if you ask local people, sometimes they'd actually rather have attractively designed, affordable homes that met local needs. But because it's Greenbelt at the moment, that choice has been taken out of their hands. So there are at least two villages that wanted to build affordable housing in Greenbelt and were blocked by the county. Now, that seems crazy. Mm. That should change.
Do you think there should be some kind of incentive system for communities that are more willing to allow for more building? Should they get something in return for that?
There are plenty of ways to let communities participate and share the benefits of more housing without having another top-down kind of system imposing that. I mean, what we're doing through the current system is blocking the negotiations that many local villages or places would like to do with landowners or developers about, well, we'll allow you to do a high-quality building here if you make a contribution to the community. And there are a whole set of things which block that with the current system: the fear of getting appealed, the fear of the council getting judicially reviewed, setting precedents, setting conditions which get stripped away by a bad developer later on, and just allowing those negotiations to happen would massively increase the quality and the volume of what we're seeing.
A lot of criticism has been placed at the feet of the developers, from politicians to people on the street, saying that it's the developers who are sitting on this land trying to make a pretty penny while other people suffer by not having access to more homes. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it? A lot of these developers are worried about building because they're scared that the rules are going to change on them, that they're going to face rejection. You know, there may be some developers who should be moving faster, but it's not so simple as to place all the blame at their feet, is it?
Well, we looked at the land banks of the top 20 developers, and we concluded that the total value of that land was less than 1/40th of the value of the land that's currently sitting under our housing stock. So
wow.
Even if they all built it tomorrow, we'd still have a massive problem. And one of the other problems is that the current system has killed the many small builders that used to operate. And if you look back in the 30s, small builders built most of their houses, and we were building much faster then than we are now. And what we see now is a much more limited supply of larger builders. That's not very healthy.
So the blame really should be on the planning regulations then?
Well, we like to say, let's have a better planning system.
Sure. You know,
and that's something that everybody can agree we should work towards.
Yeah. What, in your dream world, would that better planning system look like?
I think the answer to that partly depends on where you start from and what you can get, what you can build an alliance to achieve. So in this country, you can get a lot of support for localism. You can get a lot of support for allowing people to impose conditions as to quality and what they want in return for allowing people to build or to improve an existing place. And so moving in that direction is a very promising way forward, we think. We put out a report last year sort of suggesting that, for example, people on their own street should have the right to set a design code by a supermajority vote, say 2/3, and give themselves planning permissions to extend their own homes or even to replace them. You know, you could take a semi-detached house and replace it with a couple of terraced houses. Sometimes you can increase the square footage by a factor of 5. You can generate many more homes, and you can also double or treble the value of the original house. So there's a clear incentive there. Back to your incentive point.
Which countries around the world are getting this right?
There aren't many countries that do this exceptionally well when you have a lot of homeowners. It comes back to homeownership. So basically 2/3 of the voters are homeowners. They like seeing their house price go up.
Well, sure.
Rising house prices raise consumer confidence, and governments know that rising consumer confidence drives the re-election of that government. And so, and the Treasury actually did a study on that. And it's been an explicit or implicit objective of every government for the last 30 years for house prices to continue going up. So the problem is really political, and solving that is tricky. Now, there are places which build well and which build far faster than we have. Tokyo, for example, has built its way and reduced the housing shortage that they have, and there are places like Houston as well. You can quibble about how those places have done it, but none of them are facing the same homeowner voter majority that we have. So we have a special challenge.
And this is hard, isn't it? Because when you have a lot of young people who can't get on the housing ladder, and they're looking at people in the older generations who are becoming millionaires simply because of their house prices in a system that feels fundamentally rigged.
It's a needless bubble. It's a needless increase in prices. There's no need for this scarcity. We could actually have beautiful housing that everybody could afford and make nearly everyone better off in the process of doing it.
But homeowners just aren't sold by your arguments. So what do we need to convey to those who are really hesitant about more building?
Well, I'm not sure I'd completely agree that homeowners aren't swayed by our arguments. If you ask homeowners whether they'd like permission, for example, to whether they like the ability to vote themselves permissions to extend or replace, actually they're pretty enthusiastic about that in many places. And then similarly, if you go to a village and say, well, would you like the power to negotiate with the landowners near you, and if they come up with something sufficiently attractive and it's something that you trust, you should be able to allow them to build on that piece of land if that's what's best for the village, perhaps getting a park as well in exchange, they're also pretty much in favour of that. So the winning strategy here, and there's a huge amount of political science which has been relatively neglected in the housing space, although Mark Pennington wrote on it for the IEA some time ago, you know, tells you that the way to find strategies to win here is to find things that some of the homeowners can support and that they can see make their community and them benefit in some way from getting the houses built. And that's the only way that we can see that we're going to get an end to this shortage.
So that would suggest that maybe the fears of many homeowners aren't simply having more neighbors, but that someone's going to build something really ugly or, you know, hurt in some way the feel and the aesthetics of their community. If they're actually open-minded to, say, planning on their terms, that's really positive.
Yeah, I mean, people are risk-averse, and people know that a lot of what gets built is often of low quality or they don't like the look of it. But if you give them the control, they're far more open-minded about, and they're far more happy to have that negotiation and the discussion.
So one of the arguments I've heard is that a major issue with home ownership in the UK is that Britons feel that, not entitled to it, but they feel that it's something they need to achieve. It's one of those major boxes that they want to tick off in life. Whereas a lot of other European countries in particular don't see home ownership, don't view home ownership in the same way. They're much more comfortable with the idea of renting for a significantly longer period of time. This has never convinced me that this could solve the housing crisis, because obviously renters are badly affected by the housing crisis. Their rent goes up as there is a limited supply of homes. But is there anything to this? I mean, do you think that the UK and people who live here should rethink the value of home ownership?
On the point of perpetually rising prices, I mean, my argument is that your cartel is always doing really well when people call it a ladder, not a cartel. And that's the situation that we have here. You know, but what we also like to focus on is the economic damage. And nobody knows quite what the deadweight losses are of restricting the supply of homes near good job opportunities. There's a lot of research being done on it, especially in the States. And, you know, what the analogy I always draw to people is, well, if we had something like a Chinese hukou system where you need a permit to live in a particular city, and so we required people to have permits to live in places like Cambridge or London where it's much easier to get a job, and the value of those permits had ballooned to 3.7 trillion, which is the value of the land that sits under dwellings in the UK right now, then it would be pretty obvious that those permits, that permit system had caused massive economic damage. But because we have those permits disguised within houses, it's much more difficult to spot the damage.
It's a really good point. So you don't buy into this idea that it's simply an obsession with home ownership that's causing the problem?
Well, I mean, looking at the last 700 years of UK house prices, you see that there were 600 years from the Black Death when prices were actually fairly stable in real terms. They oscillated a bit, and then suddenly we had this massive ramp up since the 1940s. And so wanting to buy a home and own a home to sit on that line of ever-rising prices is a perfectly sensible response. You can understand why people have done it. If we don't fix the system, they're always going to see that rising line and want to buy a house.
So the elephant in the room, which you have tapped into a bit, but we'll confront it head on, is obviously the politics around house building. It seems that is what's holding everyone back. Now, this is just baffling to me, because regardless of which political party it were, I believe so strongly that the first party to make real headway with this issue, the first party to propose something meaningful, to build more homes and get more people on the housing ladder, will win the next election. It is such an important topic, especially for young people. But it's not just young people anymore. People in their mid-40s are saying, why can't I get on the housing ladder? This is ridiculous. I've been working for 20 years and I still haven't been able to save up for a deposit. So the first political party to tackle this could potentially see huge gains, and yet no one's willing to do it. Why?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's worth understanding that the parties are generally split inside as to what they want to do about it. I think what the voters' reaction will be very much depends on the details of the policy that you bring in. If you just bring in a policy that makes every single homeowner in the country worse off, at least in the very short term, and they see their house prices go down 20%, even though a lot of young people will see their rents decline or will see themselves finally able to buy a house, I'm not sure on that policy is a vote winner. So, for example, the McKelvey-Schofield chaos theorem in social choice will tell you that you can pick a policy which will assemble a coalition that will win you votes if you're careful about how you design the policy. And so that's why it's key to pick policies that some homeowners and some communities will benefit from and share in the benefits of doing that in order to make it a vote winner.
I've even seen evidence that scrapping stamp duty for first-time buyers is already having a bit of a negative effect on the housing market. You know, when you give, well, particularly with Help to Buy, when you put cash into the market, house prices just rise with whatever cash you've put in. So they're making the situation worse now. Not they're, you know, forget better. I'd love for them to make it better, but they're actually making it worse.
Well, we go back to the point that governments see it as being in their interest for house prices to go up, even if they like to make a lot of noise about doing something on the housing shortage. But when you look at the fine detail of the policy, a lot of it will just keep the prices going up.
It's so unethical. I think we're getting to a bit of a moral conundrum here. Politicians in all parties have recognized the issues of intergenerational unfairness, and they're talking a lot about that right now. For better or for worse, they're talking about some pretty radical policies to address that. Again, the one they won't touch is housing. And that's actually, I think, one of the major separations right now. Young people are doing better than their parents were at our age. You know, we're earning more. We have far more options. We have services on demand. It's hard to complain in 2018 as a young person or to say that our parents had it any better. The one area where they obviously do is that they were able to get on the housing ladder.
Yeah, I mean, the Resolution Foundation has shown that there are deciles which are worse off over the last 15 years when you net off the cost of housing. Mm-hmm. So, and the average family in the 1950s spent more on alcohol and tobacco combined than they did on housing. And I don't think it was because they were all chain-smoking alcoholics.
I mean, maybe they were having a good time, but also, yes, housing prices were much, much lower.
But I mean, I'd like to play up the positive aspects of this. There are ways forward that will give more local control, give more conditionality, but and assure higher quality development that do seem to be a way through the politics of it. So we shouldn't give up hope. There's a massive injustice, but it is fixable. We just have to focus on the details of pushing the things that we think we can get government to do.
And do local governments and local councils have power right now if they wanted to make some of those decisions, or is it too centralized?
There are whole sets of incentive problems. I mean, local councils don't really have a massive incentive to allow a lot of housing in their area. Some of them would prefer to build council housing, some of them don't want any housing at all. You know, the Swiss, for example, I think, actually will pay the chief executive, maybe pay the chief executive of council more if they get more housing built. You know, there's a pretty strong incentive there. And really has to, I think, come from central government if you want a systemic fix.
Talk to me a little bit about what UMB does to bring in some of these more positive ideas, to bring in some more of these positive reforms.
Sure. So we campaign, we're setting up, so I'm from London, YIMBY, but we're setting up YIMBY campaigns around the country, Oxford YIMBY, Cambridge YIMBY. We're working on Bristol right now. If anybody would like to set up a YIMBY group in their area, please do get in touch. You can find us at londonyimby.org. And that's one of the ways of just building a voice of the young and the others who find housing really difficult to afford right now and want a more just set of opportunities. Then the other thing, we spend a lot of time talking to government, talking to think tanks. I think it was Hayek who said, if you persuade the intellectuals, then all the others will follow. So this is one of our
nice
core activities.
Nice quote, yeah. that's great. And are you finding it relatively successful so far? I mean, do you think that you're making inroads?
Well, in the 2 years since we started, the dialogue has changed. People are much more willing to acknowledge that housing is a problem. It's far more part of the mainstream debate. I wish I could claim any credit for that. I think we were just lucky with our timing of the wave. But what we are also finding is that there's much more responsiveness on politicians to listen to policy solutions that they think might be workable. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely the key, because once they're in listening mode, there's a guy, Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, who essentially said the way to effect a change is to find a vote-winning policy and leave it on the table, and eventually some politician will steal it. That's effectively our strategy.
Sounds like a very effective one. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been great.
If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.